Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Disinformation Wars. And let me start with a little bit of an apology, because this episode is slightly tardy. The guest I have for you today has been awfully busy, and I wanted to wait and get him on before publishing. And what an episode we have. We're going to delve back into the informational dimensions of Israel's newest war against Hamas in the Gaza Strip, but we're going to do it a little bit of a different way by talking about the experience of someone who has been on those informational front lines firsthand. The way I would start is by explaining that wars have a funny way of making and breaking careers. Analysts and politicians who get things wrong tend to fall from grace and tend to move away from the public eye, while others do the opposite. They catch the public imagination and become key explainers and messengers of complex and fast-moving issues. Israel's new war is no different. More than 7 months on, it has sparked its fair share of media chaos, controversy, and information manipulation. But it's also given rise to a new crop of public diplomacy activists who are collectively blazing a trail in the war of ideas. One of them is Eilon Levy. Eilon rose to prominence in the early days of the war as a spokesman for the Israeli government. And more recently, he's been making a name for himself in the private sector as a podcaster and a public media figure. His mission, though, has remained very much the same: to punch back against the distortions, mischaracterizations, and falsehoods, and there are lots of them, that surround what Israel is actually doing in the Gaza Strip. So I was extremely grateful that he carved a little time out of his very busy schedule to sit down with me and have a chat about what he sees as his role in the informational tug of war over the conflict, and what he believes Israel's doing right and is doing wrong in what has truly become a battle of narratives about Israel, Hamas, and the future of the Israeli-Palestinian confrontation. Eilon, thanks so much for taking the time.
It's good to be here, Eilon.
The obvious place to start here, I think, is your story. You've skyrocketed to fame, to notoriety over the last 7 months as a result of the current war and also the Israeli government's efforts to try to socialize the issue, try to get its message out to the wider world. And you've done hundreds upon hundreds, I don't know the exact number, but many interviews, and there's been quite a lot of...
Around 300 internationally.
Ah, well, okay. All right. So 301 now. But the common theme throughout, I think, is that you're trying to get out information that isn't really getting out, about the war, about the context, about what the Israeli government and officialdom is thinking. And you did that first as a ad hoc spokesman for the prime minister's office. So let's start there. Tell me about how you got roped into this enterprise.
It's a really surreal story that is, I would say, the ultimate only in Israel tale. It isn't actually unique to my case, given what was happening in Israel after October 7th. This country was caught with its pants down. It was not prepared militarily, diplomatically, politically, communications-wise, for the Hamas onslaught of October 7th. The war erupted and the prime minister didn't even have a foreign media spokesperson. I started, like everyone else in the country, spending the first 24 hours moping on my sofa, then thinking I could be useful by distributing or cooking food for soldiers, until I got my act together and said, you know what, I know how to do Hasbara. I have 5 years' experience as a TV news anchor. I was the president's foreign media advisor for 2 years. This is what I'm going to do. I set up a pile of books in my living room, propped the laptop on top, set up a lamp, put out a tweet saying, hello, I'm available for interviews. And over the course of the first week, did around a dozen interviews. Around then, I get a phone call from Rotem Sela, the publisher of Sela Meir, who said, listen, we are setting up a parallel operation to support the government's communications efforts because they don't exist. Because the National Public Diplomacy Directorate at this point is four people, including a secretary. We're going to set up a parallel operation. You could call it a hostile civilian takeover if you want. I'm building a team. We're going to brief the media. We're going to help journalists. Do you want to come on board? And I said, well, of course. I mean, this is an emergency. It's all hands on deck. We'll do what we have to do. I get to the Kyria on the Friday morning after the war starts, and I see Ambassador Mark Regev there, who I've known for many years. He says, Eilon, it's good to see you. I want you to watch a few of my interviews, and from tomorrow you're on your own. I said, what do you mean on your own? Giving TV interviews? He said, yes. I said, in what capacity? He paused, put his hand on his chin and said, an Israeli government spokesman. And so it was. The following day, I was in a suit and tie without having spoken to the prime minister, any minister, really anyone who could be reasonably described as a government official, going on TV as an Israeli government spokesman. And it tells you the best and worst about Israel. The best, that this is a country that in times of emergency knows how to be flexible and creative and to give young people responsibility, send them into battle and say, you do your thing, we trust you. But the worst of Israel, because it should never have happened this way, because the people speaking for Israel should have been selected after a rigorous recruitment and training process and shouldn't have simply fallen into the position. And I hope that one of the lessons we learn, and we'll discuss this, what Israel has to do going forward, but one of the lessons going forward is this is not something we can afford to improvise. This needs to be an elite fleet of spokespeople who are properly trained and briefed and screened so that we can go to battle in what is absolutely a war zone, the information war zone. And it's directly linked to the kinetic battlefield on the ground.
No, listen, you're singing my song. I published a piece recently in the Jerusalem Post in which I advocated this exact point, which is that the tempo, the organization, the infrastructure that Israel has in terms of public diplomacy is fundamentally deficient. It has been for a long time because of scaling issues.
100%. Which, by the way, is not intended at all as criticism of the excellent people who are actually doing Hasbara. There just aren't enough of them, and they're not getting the ammunition that they need in order to fight this battle properly.
No, I think that's precisely right. And, you know, those deficiencies, as you pointed out, are sort of glaring when you have a time of crisis where it's all hands on deck. But I have a quibble, because you used this word before, and I talked about it in my piece for the Jerusalem Post, this idea of hasbara. Hasbara comes from the Hebrew word lesbir, to explain. And I think it's a little bit problematic because it's certainly what you did, right? You were out there, you were explaining the Israeli position. But in the broad information space, right, we are now over 7 months into this crisis. We are now in a very different informational ecosystem. We can sort of see it. And simply explaining, I don't think, is necessarily enough. Embedded in this idea is the sense that if only Israel was to get its side of the story out, then everybody would rally to Israel's side. And I'm not sure that's what we're seeing.
You're absolutely right. We cannot be on the defensive and explaining ourselves. You know you've lost when you're on the back foot. One thing I tried to do during the war in my official capacity was to constantly go on the offensive. My Hasbara doctrine, inspired by David Ben-Gurion, who said Israel has too narrow a waist, it doesn't have strategic depth, fight the fight on the enemy's soil. The UN owes us answers. The World Health Organization owes answers. Hamas owes us answers. The backers of UNRWA owe the world answers. We know exactly why we are fighting, and we have been wronged by a world that is complicit or going along with Hamas's, at minimum, Hamas's propaganda war against us. And I felt when I was in an official capacity, you know, there is a message sheet. And the message sheet tells you the broad points. It doesn't really prepare you for a follow-up question. And it doesn't prepare you to try to generate headlines. And the approach that I took was to go on the offensive and say, I'd rather go too far than be too timid. One of my proudest moments was forcing Philippe Lazzarini, who, as far as I'm concerned, needs to be investigated on collaboration with terrorism charges and hauled in front of a court, forcing him to respond to our allegations about UNRWA. Now, at some point, I got a slap on the wrist and I said, listen, don't go after UNRWA. We still need them. We still need to cooperate with them on humanitarian aid. I, at one point, said, the director of the World Health Organization keeps attacking Israel for the parlous state of healthcare services in Gaza, covering up the fact that Hamas is waging war out of hospitals. I said, the World Health Organization has picked a side in this war and it wants Hamas to win. It's the only possible way to explain the propaganda cover it's given. I got a slap on the wrist as well. I was told, you're going too far. You shouldn't say the World Health Organization wants Hamas to win, even though I think it's obvious because they're trying to force an end to the war that would leave Hamas on its feet. And that would be a Hamas victory if they're able to escape from the rubble that way. So Israel has to go on the offensive and be more aggressive in its communication strategy and just take the approach, if you come after us, we are going to bite back. We will not take things lying down.
And how's that effort going now? Because you're not part of the Israeli government now. You're not speaking for the Israeli government now. You're a private citizen. You're still very active on media. You have your own podcast, State of a Nation. And it's, I think, must listening for anybody who's really interested in not only delving into the complexities of the conflict, but all the ancillary things that are associated with it. But there is a trajectory here, right? You were in, now you're out. So two questions. First of all, what is the state, as you assess it, of the Israeli public diplomacy effort now that you're out of it? And second of all, how do you see what you're doing as a complement to what's happening on the official level?
There are things that official spokespeople cannot say because of diplomatic sensitivities. And when strategic countries like the United States or Egypt are concerned, they have to be very careful not to be more aggressive than the leaders, because anything they say will be attributed to Israel and the leaders set the tone. Take the question of Egypt not allowing aid stuck at Rafah to reach Kerem Shalom instead. The foreign minister has said, Israel Katz, Egypt holds the keys to averting a humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. But if you're outside the government, you can be much more aggressive. I just did an interview with Canadian TV. I said, Egypt risks provoking a serious humanitarian crisis in Gaza if it does not allow aid to reach Kerem Shalom, because it's the main crossing point. Aid reaches the Middle East through Egypt. It has to let it reach the crossing. And it's outrageous that Egypt has joined the South African suit at the ICJ, accusing Israel of genocide, while refusing to allow aid to reach the crossings, and while charging Gazans thousands of dollars to leave a war zone. Now, that's a tirade that you cannot say as an official spokesperson, because you risk having an ambassador summoned. But you can say it from civil society. And that's part of the reason that it's so important to have civil society actors who can speak and make the case that officials cannot say, because there are diplomatic sensitivities once you are official and speaking for the state.
That's an excellent point, but there's a connectivity issue there also. I mean, all of this works and all of this works really well if the government in question is really reaching out to civil society, is really harnessing influential personalities like yourself to advocate for it, right? But I'm not necessarily seeing that sort of connectivity. How is the Israeli government doing in terms of its international outreach, but also in terms of its domestic outreach, in terms of exploiting the assets that it has?
Look, I can say on a personal level, I'm spinning off to do my own independent public diplomacy initiative, but I'm absolutely working in lockstep with officials in the state. I mean, we're receiving funding from the diaspora ministry. Amichai Shikli put his hand in his pocket, or the ministry's pocket, and coughed up funding for it. I'm in touch with spokespeople wherever I need to get information, even though I'm no longer an official spokesman. As for the domestic outreach, I mean, it doesn't exist. The government doesn't have a spokesperson for the domestic media. With all due respect to Topaz Luk, who is the prime minister's spokesman, he doesn't give interviews on Israeli TV explaining what is happening. He's not giving White House style press conferences. That's what we were doing from the public diplomacy directorate. And it's the reason that, you know, the Israeli media came to nickname me Hamasbir Halumi, the national explainer, because they weren't hearing it in Hebrew, but I was the person doing it in English. And I don't think it's a coincidence that there has never been a spokesperson in Hebrew. I don't think the prime minister has ever wanted someone who would be the public face of the government and would speak for it who wasn't him. And he gives interviews very, very, very selectively. I mean, almost not at all within the Hebrew media, and controls what is said. So the main address for the Israeli public to understand what is happening, it's the military, it's the nightly updates from the IDF, not from the civilian government. The communications are almost, you know, as if martial rule has been declared.
And that causes all sorts of problems. But I don't want to get into that, because I want to go back to something that you said. You were talking about the United Nations and about UNRWA, the UN Refugee Works Administration. And it strikes me that Israel is, despite all of the heroic efforts that you made when you were in government, that you're making in your private capacity, the efforts of the rather small corpus of public diplomacy professionals that exist in the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Israel informationally is on the back foot, and is still on the back foot despite all of these efforts. So I'm wondering, because you sort of had a front row seat to all this, how is it, you know, what are the challenges here? Specifically, how and why is Hamas managing to run the tables in informational terms on Israel? How is Hamas managing to control this narrative?
Because Hamas has a whole information ecosystem supporting it. Because it has UN agencies that launder information for it. Because it has human rights organizations and NGOs that have taken the Palestinian side in the story, who see themselves as bravely standing up to colonialism, which they interpret, you know, Israel and the United States as, and will amplify their messages. And Israel doesn't have that. The ecosystem of think tanks or NGOs that will amplify Israel's message and go on TV and repeat it is extremely small. Hamas uses the United Nations to launder its information. It will put out a press release. UNRWA will then take it, copy paste, stick the UNRWA UN logo on it, and immediately it becomes the UN says. And then that will get quoted by Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur who had to be slapped down by France and Germany for saying 10/7 wasn't an anti-Semitic massacre. And she'll get cited as a UN expert who is quoting UNRWA, which is in fact a mouthpiece and a front for Hamas. And I don't think people understand how they're being played. And I think the media is complicit in this, because they know that there is no free or open media in Gaza. They know that not a single one of their fixers or sources or brave journalists has provided a single headline or image that is inconvenient to, critical of, or embarrasses Hamas. It doesn't exist, because the people they're relying on inside Gaza either support Hamas, which makes sense because much of Gaza does. It's the most popular political party. They don't like the fact that it was terrible at governing Gaza, but on the point of violent struggle against Israel, that's where it wins its points. Or at best, they're simply cowed by this authoritarian regime running its own oppressive terror state. And the New York Times had this expose a few days ago about how Hamas used its general security service to crush dissent and monitor journalists and make sure people couldn't speak freely. But the media never puts that health warning on the information. They take the information coming from journalists in, so-called journalists in Gaza, and report it as truth. There was a telling moment in an interview a while ago where Christiane Amanpour said there is no independent media in Gaza. What she meant was there are no white Westerners in Gaza, okay? You have Palestinians on the ground. Either they are independent media or they're not. If they are independent media, then you don't need Western journalists because the people on the ground are doing the same job, right? If they're not free and independent, then why are you relying on everything they say as gospel when you know that they cannot or will not show you images that are inconvenient to Hamas, how Hamas is stealing aid and operating from inside hospitals? They've never brought you that scoop. So they have a lot of control over the narrative. And unfortunately, very many people who are automatically receptive to their message and will automatically believe anything Hamas says and disbelieve anything Israel says.
I think that's part of the answer. But if I may, my sense is that there's also another dog that isn't barking. And it's in the most charitable reading of all this, it's that the international community craves information. And Hamas has positioned itself, because it controls the Gaza Health Ministry, because it controls the organs of output, because it has cowed people who would otherwise be independent journalists into submission, it controls the narrative. So the problem that you have, I think, on a very organic sense, is that even media outlets that are inclined to look at other sources are only getting one stream of information. The question, I guess, that arises is, how would Israel go about breaking that monopoly? What is it concretely that the Israeli government can do, under the assumption that the UN is not going to necessarily correct the record by itself, or as it did in recent days, where it unilaterally downgraded the number of women and children that it estimated had been killed by the IDF by like half, by 11,000 people, it at least won't publicize that it's made this correction. How can the Israeli government break that monopoly? How can the Israeli government amplify or highlight the stories that it wants highlighted?
I think it's really important to hold these officials to account and not assume that this is a price we simply have to pay. I'll give you an anecdotal example. A while ago, I was waiting to go on Sky News, and before me was Martin Griffiths, the UN relief coordinator, who said, I've worked with many terrorist organizations in the past in war zones. Hamas, of course, is not a terrorist organization as far as we're concerned. I did eyebrows like Kay Burley, okay, while I was waiting to go on air. I got off the interview. I clipped his interview, put it online. I said something like, no wonder the UN is lobbying to end the war with Hamas in power when it doesn't even think Hamas is a terrorist organization. Within minutes, the foreign ministry retweets it. Our ambassadors around the world take the same clip. Germany decides to throw some shade at him by saying that they consider Hamas to be a terrorist organization. He's forced to put out a correction saying, I wasn't downplaying the atrocities of October 7th. I meant they're not on the UN's list of terror organizations. The German foreign ministry tweets back at him, well, they're on our list of terror organizations. And it goes all the way to the White House, where I think John Kirby was, had to respond to it. And that's because I was monitoring the media, cut the clip and put it online. So you have to hold these people to account and make sure that it resonates in public, in headlines. And we have to help our allies understand how dangerous these norms are if they're allowed to become common practice. Terrorists don't get immunity just because they hide in the basement of a hospital, no matter how many times UN officials will try to claim that that's the case. That cannot become the baseline of customary international law.
But as you pointed out a number of times now, there's a lot of things that are being unsaid. And American attitudes and American sentiment looms very large. Jerusalem and Washington have a special relationship that goes back decades, but it would be fair to say that it's being strained almost to the breaking point, at least rhetorically, as a result of disagreements over the war. And it seems to me, at least looking from the outside, that at least part of this friction could be eliminated or at least lessened by greater information sharing in the public domain about not only Israel's war aims, but also more transparency about what's happening on the battlefield. And we know that this is happening on the classified level, but the sense of distance between the US government and the Israeli government is, I think, very injurious. It's very injurious to Israel's public standing. And it seems to me that there's more that can be done here.
Look, there's plenty more that we can be doing. By the way, I think Israel's been doing a much better job than in previous wars. There is no other military in the world that is required to account for the velocity and direction of every single bullet. And you know, you have a lifetime's reading material just from the IDF telegram updates about this battle taking place here and what is going on and exposing Hamas operations inside civilian facilities. The information is there. But you know, the tension with the United States only emphasizes the importance of the information war, because it is public opinion that determines the positions of decision makers and policy makers and what they're hearing and what impressions they have about you and about what their involvement with you means by implication. And so we need to do better, I mean, undoubtedly. And it's just not a war that Israel can afford to lose.
Well, and that's such a crucial point, because you're absolutely correct that the information is out there, but it's being read by a vanishingly small cohort of people. There are very, very few people that I know here in Washington that actually are so attuned to the tempo of Israeli military operations that they're actually following religiously, that they're following right. The sort of the updates. And so maybe that's part of the answer about what Israel can do. Popularizing the information that's already out there, conveying it to policymakers in digestible chunks, that seems to be the dog that isn't barking.
Right. And policymakers are influenced through direct diplomacy and also through the news that they receive directly, because CNN or MSNBC or whatever is on in the background in their office, and by what pressures they're getting from their constituents who are also following the news. And so you have to be strategic, and you can't just vomit information on them. You need to, I will often get off an interview and kick myself and say, you could have said that more succinctly. Because at the end of the day, this isn't a lecture. You're trying to say things that will be catchy and people will stay in their heads. And the next time they're talking about this issue, the sentence will roll off their tongue because they heard it on TV and it was catchy. And that's something that comes through improvisation, sometimes the right turn of phrase comes during an interview, but is also something that I think in a professional communications environment is more established and strategic in terms of trying to come up with sound bites and sentences that spokespeople can use.
Last question for you, because we are sort of migrating into the territory that really gets my juices flowing. I heard someone recently say that Israel's war with Hamas will go down in history as the first truly informational war, in the sense that the informational space has as significant an impact on the course of the conflict as does military operations. I think that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but not much of one. And so understanding that this war of ideas, this war of narratives has become so overridingly important as a private citizen, having been in government, understanding what Israel is actually dealing with in the information space, what do you think the most important contributions are? What do you think the most important innovations are where Israel can go from here?
There's so much, but if I had to distill it to three things, I would say this. First of all, Israel needs a sayeret, as we say in Hebrew, an elite force of spokespeople in every language who are full-time paid professionals. Israel needs to have a government spokesperson in English, French, German, Russian, Spanish, Arabic, Farsi, Portuguese, Norwegian, and Swedish. Okay? Because there's a limit to how much these foreign language channels can bring on a simultaneous translator. There needs to be someone doing it in their language. We're a global people. We have a powerful diaspora. We have a prosperous Olé community. It should not be beyond our means to recruit someone who is telegenic, understands geopolitics, and can speak and argue eloquently. And if they don't exist, you find the diamond in the rough and you polish them. There is no country in the world that is forced to explain itself 24/7 in every language. We are, and we have to rise to the challenge. They need to be briefed properly in terms of getting the right news, getting the right quotes, getting the right sound bites, getting the right messages, getting the ammunition they need. The second thing is that the public diplomacy operation has to be run like a crisis communications center. They need to get out of thinking about what is a campaign that we can do about, you know, an ad here or projecting faces of hostages on a wall there, and start monitoring the news and thinking what headlines are popping up. How do we put out that fire? What report is expected to come out? How are we going to challenge that? Because what we were doing was not good enough. There wasn't enough coordination. You know, they think that there was this big conspiracy to try to target UNRWA. When we discovered that UNRWA's HQ was feeding electricity to a server farm underground. I found out from a tweet by Manny Fabian from the Times of Israel, who'd been taken in, embedded. That information had not reached the spokespeople. I'd heard that we'd found something because I'd heard rumors through the grapevine. Israel's a small country, but we need to do better at making sure that we are dealing with crisis communications and we don't allow things to get out of control without a response. And the third thing is activating the diaspora. They don't feel they have a central address for where to get their messages and where to get their information. And part of what I am trying to do now with this new public diplomacy initiative that we're launching, that we're hoping to officially launch and brand in the coming days, is to create a central address that is non-governmental, but based on official information, where the diaspora can get reliable facts, figures, and messages, because they want to help us and they need help in knowing what to say and how to articulate themselves, and they'll be a very powerful force multiplier. So many other things we could go on and on and on, but I think if Israel manages to institute those three changes, we can begin to really fight back and be wherever Israel is under attack and never allow a hostile TV report or interview to go without a response.
Ilan, thank you for all the work that you're doing, all the work that you're going to be doing. If you don't subscribe, if you don't listen to Ilan's podcast, State of a Nation, you absolutely should. I'll add a link to it in the show notes. And I guess we should stay tuned.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.